Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
Summer finally got to the west coast of the United States, so the Beach Boys have to get played, and Grant Newsham, again, gets around the world a little bit, so he's in Taipei now, so he joins the program. Grant, good morning, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. It was asleep 14 hours, so I'm feeling better now.
Well, that will tend to do it, so... So, first of all, thanks for joining us here on a Tuesday morning. The you just had a piece written in AND magazine, U.S.-China Trade War, Time to Speak Clearly. The president obviously, well, wait a minute. Okay, before we talk about that, I have a more general topic. The 75th anniversary of Normandy happened late last week, and one of the things I kind of opined a little bit about, some people would call it an opinion piece, but I just call it what I do. So in watching all the different things, you know, that were on TV and doing a little bit of reading and just my own thoughts, as I'm looking at that beach, I'm thinking, it's a pretty expensive price to pay to get back into Europe. And then the thought came to me that it was a pretty expensive price to pay for not standing up to the German government that had embraced National Socialism and led by Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. And I thought, you know, if the free world doesn't learn anything from World War II, I would think it would learn one lesson, and that is this. Confronting totalitarianism is a historical blunder of significant proportions. And I say that because I looked up how many people died, or estimates of how many people died in World War II. And it was 3% of the planet's population died of either directly because of the fighting, combat, civilian, quote-unquote, collateral damage, or gas chambers, or disease, and other forms of death that were attributable to the war. That's between 70 and 85 million people when you put that number together. So I'm curious about your thoughts. I mean, because it seems to me, and we've talked about this repeatedly, that, you know, that China coming to the world of that free democracies have created in the post-World War II era and becoming a full member of that seems like that's not China's agenda. And the longer that is postponed, the higher the price tends to be. But it seems like we as free nations have not learned that lesson. Your thoughts on all of that?
I think you're right. I don't think we've learned that lesson at all. We've just after some period of time, people with direct memory, there's fewer and fewer of them, but it's also worth remembering that, say, even in the 1930s and even after World War II during the Cold War, there's always been a huge constituency in America, say, academic elite, the foreign policy class, the political world, who basically favor appeasement, you know, who see us as the problem. You know, in the 1930s, this was just why the thinking that, look, you know, Hitler he's got his issues, but he's right about a lot of things. We can overlook these concentration camps, you know, he's a little rough, but, you know, Germany was in chaos and they needed somebody like him. The highways are great. The trains run on time, etc. And the business world is, of course, yapping to do business if there's money to be made, regardless of what sort of criminality is going on. And then suddenly, once the war starts, that it's like, never mind, And it's as if nobody was ever saying those things, when in fact a sizable part of the, you know, that our ruling class, the elite classes, were saying this sort of thing. It was this collective agreement that nobody would talk about how wrong these people were, how they aided and abetted this just pure evil. And then they get, and you, in fact, you read the histories and just the common narrative, and you think that the entire United States was supporting Britain, was against Hitler and the Nazis were, you know, and from the very beginning, when in fact the exact opposite was the case. In the case of American businesses, the only reason they stopped doing business with the Germans, with the Nazis, was because of financial sanctions put in place December 8th that made it impossible for them to cash their checks. And then you go to the Cold War era. And once again, the thinking was, well, the only reason that the Russians are, you know, behaving unpleasantly is because they're afraid of us. So there was actually huge opposition, once again, in the elite ruling classes in America against reinstituting the draft, for example, the idea being, well, it would irritate Stalin. And then go back into our memories, you know, of our experiences. You remember the early 80s. About deploying Pershing missiles to Europe, the neutron bomb, just the venom that was directed against Ronald Reagan and the people who supported standing up to the Russians. Now, you may remember that TV show The Day After, which is an anti-nuclear bomb thing, or really an anti-U.S. policy movie. That was the talk of the United States for a bit. And so there's always been this appeasing class. And I really don't think we learn a thing. I've gone on a while here, but the last thing I'll say is, you know, I worked for a Wall Street firm for over a decade, and you would always hear that, you know, whenever some scheme, or which was effectively a pyramid scheme or something designed to really separate unsuspecting people from their money, you'd always hear, well, this is different. You know, this one isn't a scam. You know, this one isn't a pyramid scheme. You know, this is a can't miss deal. And it was always, this is different. You just don't understand. So if, you know, I am sure there's a long line of people who can tell you and I why we just don't understand, why this is different, why China is somehow, just like it's really just a billion and a quarter Canadians. There's nothing to fear here, nothing to fear from the Chinese Communist Party. They just want their place in the sun, which is an expression the fascists in the 30s used. Admittedly, it's only 6:09 in the morning in Taipei, but I didn't wake up optimistic, and you've made me less so. You just see this, and you just, really the last thing, you know, we use a word quisling, you know, all the time to describe a traitor who will sell out his country, to an enemy, and a bad enemy. Not that there's good enemies, but a bad one. And it refers to Vidkun Quisling, the Norwegian, who just collaborated from even before the invasion with the Germans. And I use this word with an American, young American Marine who must be about 28 or so these days, and he had no idea what the word meant. So it gives you, and you, just talking to younger people, you get a sense of how, you know, we talk about World War II and much less before that, and it's almost like, I don't know, somebody talking about the French and Indian War when you and I were young. So maybe that's how it's always been. Maybe the Greeks wrote plays about tragedies and comedies about this 2,500 years ago.
You know, it's interesting. And then as I was kind of doing research, I don't know how George Marshall got into my head, but he got into my head. So I went and kind of did a little Marshall reading, and Marshall either built or was a part of building or rebuilding the United States Army on three separate occasions, in the building and training to go to World War One, in the building for World War II, and then in the rebuilding for the Korean War. And his conclusion was, the only way that we can keep from fighting wars like this is to have a large enough standing army that in combination with our allies would render anybody's desire to go to war with us as to be just absolutely foolish and completely destructive. And so so you read some of the things that, and Marshall never wrote his memoirs, but I mean you might be talking about arguably one of the greatest Americans of the 20th century in terms of what he did. And you know, his conclusion of, hey, we need a standing army, we need strong alliances, and everybody's got to do enough so together nobody can mess with us, and therefore we will live in a rules-based world order, a law-based world order based on international law that we provide. And no dictator, no totalitarian state is going to show up and demand that the free nations of this world dance to their music. And so, you know, in listening to those things and some of the lectures I listened to about Marshall, it's stunning that we find ourselves essentially in a same position. You know, we're gonna take out Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo, and instead we're gonna put Putin, Xi, Kim, and which version of Khomeini in Iran. You're going to slide those names in for dictators that are attempting to say, no, up is not towards the ceiling anymore, up is that way, right? And so it doesn't matter, you know, are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? And so it's just, to me, stunning when you put that all together that we find ourselves, and think about 3% of the world's population, 70 to 85 million people died in World War II. I mean, that's stunning to think about, that for the lack of the Allies saying, all right, we're going to need X number of divisions and we're going back to Germany. Okay, they don't have a whole lot to fight us with, but, you know, we'll probably take some casualties. But we're gonna renegotiate the Versailles Treaty, and we're gonna give them some room that they need economically. But we're not gonna play the real estate game. We're not gonna do any of that. But for the lack of the will to that, 70 to 85 million people die. And your thoughts on that mouthful?
Well, you can add another 50 to 70 Chinese who died once the communists took over in China in 1949. And that didn't have to happen. As you said, I think I'm just expanding the numbers. None of this, you know, the Holocaust wouldn't have happened, you know, the Cold War wouldn't have happened, and, you know, a lot of misery would have been avoided. And, you know, you've laid it out, and the cost would have been just nothing. And, you know, often the allies, the civilized world had responded when Hitler and the Germans, it wasn't just Hitler by himself, it was the Germans, marched into the Rhineland. It's known that if the West, the civilized West had responded to that, the German military was ready to get rid of Hitler. The cost of that, it would have been nothing. And all of these things could have been avoided, you know, if just with a small bit of effort. And yet we don't seem to learn that lesson. I think you compared Xi, Putin, Khomeini et al. To the, you know, Hitler, Tojo, Mussolini. And I would have to agree, but it really varies only in the details.
Right.
And that's what the chattering class will tell you is, oh, it's not the same. It's always, oh, this is different. Just like a Wall Street guy foisting a pyramid scheme onto somebody. And you hear that, you know, all the time. I would note about George Marshall that he's, I think, maybe the second most famous person to come out of Uniontown, Pennsylvania. And my mother was from a coal town, coal village near Uniontown. So George Marshall was always beloved. But I think the most famous was probably Chuck Muncie, the running back from Uniontown High, who went to Cal and then played for the Chargers for a few years back in the 80s.
Right. No,
so Marshall was only the second most famous.
Quite the running back in his day. He was one of those guys who kind of broke the mold, you know, Jim Brown-esque in terms of size and speed. But Marshall, you know, to me, the more I read about him, the more I just how interesting I find him. You know, the less – thing that really I read that I shouldn't say stunned me, but it so impressed me was that, you know, the refrigerators, the washing machines, all the things that we sent to Western Europe post-war, that wasn't just for Europe. That was, he engineered the soft landing of the American economy as it transitioned from war production to peacetime, and, you know, the millions of people that would be thrown out of work. And I mean, that was his brainchild and the brainchild of the people that he put together. And so you just see his, you know, you see his, you know, brilliance in all sorts of things. And, I don't know, it just, you know, that whole series of thoughts came from watching, you know, all the different scenes from, you know, early in the week in England and then late in the week in France. It's just like, wow. What a huge endeavor, what a terrible cost of life. And because we wouldn't stand up, you know, Neville Chamberlain was going to have peace in our time, and you appease totalitarian leaders. And it just seems to me that we are going down the exact same road. And the only thing that you do when you delay that reconciliation is you make the cost worse. You make the cost worse.
And you said it's like avoiding a trip to the dentist. And just taking a shot of whatever.
Right.
It solves an immediate problem, but in the end, you are going to pay for it many, many times over. It's also worth remembering about George Marshall is the opposition that he faced really throughout his career, both, you know, in the military and then as Secretary of State. But just not just opposition, but the venom that was directed against him throughout. And that's it's always the case, but in hindsight, nobody talks about it, particularly the people who were criticizing him most fiercely. So even now that people who've been, you know, sort of who were warning about what was coming with China, all of which was perfectly obvious, they were all castigated as China hawks and warmongers, etc. And now that it's sort of realized that China is, once again, not like Canadians, that nobody's mentioned, nobody is saying they're sorry that they made a mistake. It's really like that old Saturday night skit where this nutty lady would go on and on and on, and then when told she was, you know, you're wrong, she would simply say, well, never mind. And that's what an Ivy League education will do for you, apparently. You can see I usually burn off resentment by about 2 a.m.
I don't know. I don't know. It seems to be long in you.
To use a financial term. You know, I did see the movie The Longest Day on the airplane coming over from the U.S. just the other day, speaking of D-Day.
Any thoughts as a retired Marine? You know, those are things that you and I certainly grew up with that were, you know, from when the movie The Longest Day came out, the documentary series World at War, Victory at Sea. I mean, we didn't have YouTube, and so those were kind of the major tipping points for us. Any thoughts about the whole Normandy thing 75 years later?
I suppose one thing, I'm not the most organized guy, so I really wouldn't have wanted to be the embark officer for that operation. If you step back and you get a sense of the scale of the whole thing, and one is in awe, you know, and keep in mind this was all done without PowerPoint and without computers, and it's staggering just how well this went, how the deception operation to make sure that Dolph thought that Hitler thought that, you know, the landing was coming in the Pas-de-Calais. Was astonishing. I don't think we could do anything like that today. Maybe we could if we sort of girded our loins and got our wits about us. But they were able to keep secrets back then. And maybe another point of interest is that, you know, even now, one's been hearing that amphibious operations are irrelevant, obsolete, impossible these days, but they've probably been saying that since Julius Caesar went after pirates in Asia Minor some years back that, oh, there'll never be amphibious operations. But somehow they seem to survive and they have a usefulness. And, you know, while the specifics may vary, and seeing a D-Day sort of attack may not happen tomorrow, that nonetheless the usefulness is still there. And the fact that the U.S. Army pulled it off one can debate that however they want. And I've seen or heard Army people throw that out to demonstrate that the Marines have no purpose, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they conducted the largest amphibious landing in the history of the world.
Well, you hear that all the time, right. But once again, well, let's talk about this. It's a debating point. But it ought not to be used as a way to sort of displace the Marines or to score some points for an army, which, you know, hasn't done all that well in its two most recent campaigns.
No need to be a hater. No need to be a hater. Well, you know, again, the world got told that amphibious operations were made moot in a nuclear age, and then the Marine Corps executed Incheon, which arguably might be its greatest amphibious moment ever. And so I agree with you. You know, just you say these things, you know, are old and passe, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're here again, and we all marvel at it.
And I remember in the first Gulf War that these younger, and this was I remember having this specific reaction talking to young Marines who were going to over to Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. I remember thinking, you know, this is the same kind of guys that got in the boats at Iwo Jima. I really had the impression it was the same raw material, the same sort of guys that won wars. I think it's still a useful capability, it's essential, and I think we'd still do fortunately have the same type of people who actually landed on the coast of France and 9 months later had exterminated the German army. I think we still have that. You know, it'd be good if we remember it more often. But, you know, I was born 10 years after, or 11 years after D-Day, 12 years. And so that's really something that, you know, I'm very familiar, you know, it just was part of, you know, our worldview. And you just can't help but being impressed with what was done, how it was done, and also why it was done. And why it had to be done. And once you start to think about that, and really is something, though I suspect in another 50 years it'll be maybe talked about the way we talk about, some long-fought battle. But I hope not, but maybe that's the way things always go.
Interesting. Watching the events of last week, kind of jogged my mind and connecting dots, things that we talk about here that you've made us very smart about. It just seems like, what the President of the United States atypically is asking for is for the Chinese simply to join the rest of the nations in some pretty basic reforms. But as you and I have also talked, those basic reforms strike at the heart of who controls the Chinese economy. So if Xi accepts those reforms, then what? Does he lose power, and are people that control various parts of the Chinese economy, are they empowered? I think it's interesting to take a look at, you know, it's not just a question of intellectual property and the stealing of it. It's the implications of that. And why can't the Chinese agree to that? And what does it mean for their system? And so, so very interesting. But again, I think at some point the Chinese are going to have to take that step. And, I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear from their side why they can't do it, knowing at some point the world. I mean, I don't know. I'd love to sit in their OPT about, do they really believe that they will bend the entire planet to their will economically? Everybody, and you would have to think that at some point they would think that, well, it's going to be a mixed bag. Okay, what does that cost us? And how would we do it? So I'd like to sit in that OPT.
Yeah, I would too. You could just watch an episode of The Sopranos or two when they're sitting in their social club talking about things. It's nobody's talking about how do we smoothly transition sort of to a consensus. You know, how do we give up power? How do we give up all this stuff we have? It's all about how do we keep it,
right.
And anything goes to keep it. So if you can't get to Beijing, I think if you just go online, you can probably find some Sopranos episodes.
All right. I want to talk about something you wrote. Actually, that's where we started here a few minutes ago before I detoured the discussion. The title of this, it appears in AND Magazine, andmagazine.com. U.S.-China trade war - time to speak clearly. Talk to us. Speak clearly to us about this.
What I was getting at in the article is that the with all these trade sanctions, tariffs, and things that the U.S. government and under the Trump administration has put in place to try and stand up for U.S. interests and also to shape Chinese behavior, that these are all well and good. It's important to keep in mind that the Chinese really, and we see these as being necessary, in fact, long, long overdue, and we see it as a reasonable approach to really 40 years of, China savaging us economically. To us, many Americans, most Americans probably, that makes perfect sense. And then I point out that, but to Chinese, particularly at that ruling class level, and even many men in this sort of man in the street types, this is all seen as an effort to keep China down and, keep China from competing, to keep it from getting a technological edge on the United States. It's creating a sort of resentment in China. China's always, even on a good day, it's always been resentful. But the trade at war, the trade sort of sanctions have made it even more resentful. And so it now has what I refer to as a full-blown case of resentment. And this is potentially dangerous. It's something that does need to be kept in mind and treated with caution, because you do find that countries like drunks in a South Boston bar can kind of talk themselves into a fight by 1 a.m. And
so what do they resent, Grant, that the United States isn't playing the emperor's new clothes?
Well, we see it that way. We see it that way, but they see it as, man, the man's keeping us down. As really the United States preventing China from taking its lawful place in the world. And say that's how we see it. And then the Chinese government regime cynically uses the so-called century of humiliation to further rile the population.
Right.
And the concern, one this risk, of course, is that these kind of regimes can kind of back themselves into a corner, and to the point that they cannot back down once they've sort of stoked fury and envy and resentment in the population. They just can't do it. And at that point, you sometimes find the psychological shift that says, a fight is in the national interest. In fact, it's necessary for national, which really means regime survival. And you can actually get to that point. And that's something that needs to be, either prepared for addressed on the U.S. side. Here's the point of the sort of where I get to in the piece.
Yeah, so why should we care that they resent? We resent, right, that they think that they are going to, have the entire planet dancing to their tune. I think everybody resents that. So who cares what the Chinese resent?
That ultimately, that has to be part of our thinking, is sort of forever, the response to almost any American policy, either military or commercial, is, but what will the Chinese think? It would be good to have for a while the Chinese thinking, what will the Americans think about something they do? So what I get to is that the Chinese have actually been very good at, I think, effective at getting their position, you know, their mindset across, you know, the so-called century of humiliation. And you know, you'll have many, many Westerners who can immediately sort of spout that excuse for why China is doing what it's doing, why we should be more sensitive to Chinese concerns. And what you don't hear, despite some of the effective measures that the Trump administration has finally put in place, you don't really hear a narrative from the U.S. side as to why America is doing this. And it's not well explained. It's not consistently or coherently put forth so that, I say, Americans, but as importantly, people overseas, you know, our allies, our friends, and people who potentially could be, they don't have this easy internalized recognition of why America is doing what it's doing, why it's important to America, and why it's important to everyone else in the free world. And this is a failure of what is today called strategic communications, in the original sort of Jesuit use of the word propaganda, which just meant explaining yourself properly. It's a failure of propaganda. The U.S. has not been able to present a clear explanation that people understand and internalize as to why it is doing what it's doing. And this is what I suggest that the administration needs to get right and quickly. And it's not the Trump administration that's the first one to stumble here. This has been a problem with U.S. Propaganda or strategic communications, goodness, since at least the 1970s. I'm told reliably that there are people on the U.S. government payroll whose job is strategic communications. Whatever they do appears to be a well-kept secret, because there's certainly no evidence that they even show up to work. It is about that bad. But it's something that needs to be addressed. Some people will point to, with some, there's something to it, that in the late 80s or early 90s, the old USIA, the United States Information Agency, or USIS, United States Information Services, was actually sort of melded into the State Department. The idea was that this would save a few million dollars here and there. And what it did is it gutted whatever sort of strategic communications operations we had. And once it goes into the State Department, it becomes sort of its unloved stepchild. You know, the perception is, well, only losers work there. They're not the real foreign service officers. And that has cost us just billions, if you can put a price, on America being unable to really explain itself. And which is ironic, given that U.S. businesses can sell people anything. The master marketeers, you know, they can sell people stuff they don't need or want. And yet our government has a very hard time selling something which needs to be sold. So that was the article, is that, you know, pointing out that, you know, how the Chinese see these efforts as a very, very serious attack on their legitimate interests. And that is potentially dangerous once resentment takes hold. But that what's missing, one thing that is missing on the U.S. side is the strategic communications to explain why we're doing what it is, and also why it matters to the civilized world. So I probably spoke just about 2,000 words now, but the piece was only 850 words.
I think that we haven't articulated, probably for good reason, these thoughts, because nobody until Donald Trump has stood up and attempted to enforce them. So it was, I'm sure, before, gives yourself a lot of wiggle room, because we're not going to confront the Chinese because there's a political cost to do so, because the Chinese, you know, they'll tighten access to the market. They'll throw people out of work. That will cost jobs. You'll pay for it at the election, at the ballot box, because the economy will be poor, and we don't need that, right? I need to be reelected. That's the first goal of a politician. And so to me, for want to be reelected, You know, that is the fuel that fuels the Chinese economic engine, that we will grant you this access to this wonderful demand for whatever you produce, we have a demand for. And all your boats will rise, but these are the terms that we will operate under. And so it's beautifully simple. You know, it is somewhat Soprano-esque, although I've never seen the program, in terms of addicted to what they're addicted to. We will give that to them, and then we'll use that to get what we want. And what we want is the rules-based economic order that has existed since World War II, and to an extent somewhat before, but certainly afterwards, will be a thing of the past as we define who has access to the Taiwan Strait, that we define who owns Taiwan, even though we have no historical claim, that we lay down the 9-dash line and annex everybody, all those minerals, all those resources in the region, and nobody will have a say because we're the biggest kid on the block. And so it's amazing to watch, and I would think that there would be some danger in us articulating that goal, Grant, because then to take it back, somebody would ask the question, we'll say, wait a minute, I thought these were the reasons for the long-term economic health of the world, right, for the protection of intellectual property, which we say we do in this country, that we could no longer go down this road with the Chinese. You mean you're telling me that you're going to cast those aside? And you would get some gobbledygook about how, of course, we wouldn't cast those aside. However, though, there's some pragmatic considerations here, you know, and that is Americans going back to work and tariffs, which is a tax on the American people, blah, 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 blah. And then somewhere in the midst of that gobbledygook, there would be a reversal of position that hopefully nobody would notice. And it wouldn't cause too much of a kerfuffle. As hopefully the votes would pour into the Mac vote for Mac election box, but it just seems that we do that to harm the nation, and I want to kind of a case in point of this. I don't know, here in the last few days, I keep seeing the Philippines in the news, that the Philippines now are asking other allied nations to help them in this kind of little dust-up they have going with China, although you say that they'll do that on one hand. On the other hand, they're sending their business representatives to mainland China to make sure. So it's a bit of theatrics. Was that just more theatrics, you know, this week?
I think so. But that said, what it does indicate, I think, is that in the Philippines, you've got, you know, at least two sort of schools of thought, two factions. You have the one that is sort of pro-China, and the other, but there's a huge constituency at all levels that is effectively pro-United States. So we have something to work with if we work with it effectively. But the idea that somehow that you know this isn't shifted decisively one way or the other, I think it's not yet the case. But you do have to get in there and influence. And that's how I would tend to see the Philippines, is that the outcome is still a ways to go, and it could go either way, you know, really become effectively a Chinese satrap or sort of under Chinese domination, or you could get a reaction to this, sort of this Chinese appeasement, bribe taking, etc., that's going on. But it is worth remembering that Duterte still does seem to have a lot of popular support, and that, you know, is something one can't wish away. That it is there. Jumping back just a little bit, as you were talking about the strategic communications thing and the fear of upsetting China. You know, I will recall that before the military is not immune to that. I remember, in fact, before the Dawn Blitz 13 exercise down near where you are, off Camp Pendleton, that I was interviewed briefly by the Associated Press. and they were asking about the Japanese coming to America to train with the Americans. And I made a comment very close to the following. I said, if recent history has taught us anything, it's that when the free nations get together to defend themselves, it has a stabilizing effect.
Right.
And the Marine Corps' ruling class, their hair lit on fire. The public affairs community, which is generally subpar, they were even more incensed, and the courtier class was equally angry for having actually said what I just said. The idea was the Chinese would be angry. And so I was a reservist, of course, so there was, you know, I had sort of limited interest in what they had to say, and there was bigger things at work, which was to get the Japanese able to defend themselves and to be a useful ally to us. But it was irksome to have to deal with that. But it did, once again, it shows how even in the military, and it's not just the Marines, I'd say all the services, you had a ruling class and a courtier class, which was very attuned to what was going on in Washington, D.C., and shaped their language accordingly. I will note that I was, and this is funny, that, you know, whilst there was so much resentment to what I said, probably a week later on board the Hyuga, then CG-1 MEP, General Tulin, gave just a wonderful speech, wonderful comments at a press briefing, explaining that what we were here was to fight and fight our enemies, and that's what it was all about. And it was, I was just delighted to hear it. He said it like just perfectly. And the reaction to him was a little different than it was to me. But I noticed it more than most people. But there is that need to really explain yourself clearly so people understand. And you may remember, in speaking of World War II, the Why We Fight series.
Yes.
That I think George Marshall probably had a hand in it. That was the idea, was to explain why we were doing what we were doing to a number of people, and that needed to know it, including the citizenry writ large, and even the military. And that's back then we still did we were pretty good at that kind of thing, and into the Cold War for a number of years, and then we've lost it. But so anyway, I jumped back. But now,
well,
back
let me, Grant, why? Haven't we explained, you know, our economic confrontation with them? Why isn't in the front window? Why? Is there a reason why we haven't done that?
You know, I don't know. You know, if you said, I'll give you $1 million if you can explain it. I suppose if I thought for an hour or two, I could maybe come up with some ideas, but it really comes down to incompetence.
Really?
I don't know how else to put it.
Do we not want to anger the Chinese?
Well, I think the D.C., Washington, D.C., simply cannot get its act together. And for that, an administration has to ultimately take the blame. Regardless of administration, but there are those motivations, is don't offend the Chinese. But we do also have different constituencies in the U.S. You have the business community part of it, which thinks it's going to get fabulously wealthy in China.
Right.
You have Wall Street, which would, you know, thinks the same thing and is doing very well when it just by, you know, from the China business. In the political world, you have people who don't want to allow an administration to look like it's successful. Within an administration, you know, you got people who are busy, have a lot of things to do, and they sort of, for whatever reason, can't get the time to work out a decent, coherent statement. And then you have people who just aren't very good at what they do, or simply don't want to cooperate. Just because they don't want to cooperate with anyone. And sometimes getting simple things done in D.C., in the United States, can be very difficult. And maybe a lot of these things track back to human nature. But we really haven't had, you know, if you think, you know, who is it that, name one person who really is a good spokesman for the U.S., for what the U.S. stands for. And I think in the article I mentioned that Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador, Now and Then was very good, but she's gone. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, often he speaks very well. But he does sometimes stumble in the next sentence. But I think he potentially could be very good. I can't think of anybody, back since, remember Daniel Moynihan, Senator
yes,
Moynihan?
Yes, absolutely.
Back in the 70s, or Gene Kirkpatrick.
Big brain.
The UN ambassador. And these people were articulate and listened to, and also overseas as well. When they spoke up for the United States. But those were in the 70s and 80s, so it's been a good while since we've had, somebody that, really is sort of the voice of freedom. Maybe someone will come along, but, we'll see.
I want to switch gears. I saw a report that talked about the Chinese effort to essentially erase the events at Tiananmen Square. Did you see that? I mean, it tends to be the way totalitarian states operate, is that if it's not something we care to address and not something that we can live with, well, then we'll just make it go away. Did you see any of that and your thoughts on that?
Oh yeah, I read the coverage on that, and it's really par for the course. It's what the Chinese Communist Party will do. It's what communist parties everywhere will do, and it didn't surprise me. They probably had a degree of success with it, but they one wonders and what I would compare it to is, if you remember, you don't remember, I don't either, but I know of it, the Hungarian Revolution.
Yes.
Or the Hungarian Uprising of 1956.
Right.
That, this happened, and Hungarians were taking on Russian tanks in the streets and had some initial success. And of course, the Russians caught their breath and came back and smashed the Hungarian freedom fighters. And arrested a number of people, imprisoned a few, 20,000 or so, and executed a number of them as well. And then I remember by the 70s or so, when I was sort of aware of international stuff and interested in it, that this was like an ancient event that almost had never happened, except in the history books. And the thinking was that, it's not really an issue anymore in Hungary. A new generation has come. People, they don't really care. The government doesn't talk about it. If you do, you get arrested. Many of the participants, a lot of people fled, actually, right at, during, and in the aftermath of the uprising. So you had this, a lot of the people who were most angry had left. And the idea was, well, they don't really mind in Hungary. Eastern Europe's always been a tough place. The regime, gives them food, gives them jobs, and the Hungarian regime is a little better than most in the Soviet bloc because they can travel a bit more freely. They can have blue jeans and jazz music records easier than most other places in the communist world. So they don't really mind it. And that was very much the thinking in a lot of academia and the foreign policy class and even the political world. And there was even a sense of why even bring this up? Why even talk about it? Because it just irritates the Russians. It's not going to do any good, etc. And then, by 1989, the whole thing comes apart, and everybody wants the Russians to go away and the communists to go away. And so what I'm suggesting is that even in China, despite the efforts to erase Tiananmen Square to really suppress any talk of it, any memory of it, and the fact that a lot of Chinese who have fled really after Tiananmen Square, that a new generation has come, which we always hear is only interested in making money, doesn't care about politics. I wouldn't be so sure. Just like in Hungary and the rest of the Soviet bloc, that I think there is a sort of yearning for freedom. Freedom can mean different things to different people, but I would suggest a freedom that we would recognize and that it has a way of coming out at unpleasant time or unexpected times for regimes like this. One never quite knows when or why or how. That's one of the things that you can take out of, say, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's books, particularly the ones about his experiences in the Soviet prison camps and the gulags, that, you know, talk about miserable conditions in a miserable regime that was as willing as a regime can be to murder people that oppose it. And yet, despite all of this, you had this yearning for freedom that was there. And I think China is probably the same thing. How it will play out, I don't know. But that's when I hear about the Tiananmen Square thing. I am reminded of the Hungarian uprising and also how it was considered by the American elite classes. You know, it was considered irrelevant and just didn't matter. Because it was, as I said, very much a sense that the East Europeans weren't really unhappy under Soviet domination and communist rule. But they got that wrong, and I wonder about China. You know, I have a feeling that it may not be the regime might not be in quite as much control as it likes to think, and may not be in quite as much control of people's thinking as it likes to present itself. I think it knows good and well that it's sitting on a powder keg, is my take. So that's how I saw it. Now we'll see. It's hard to believe it's been 30 years.
It's interesting, Grant, that even as far as physically reconfiguring Tiananmen Square so that any scars of the event cannot become shrines and whatnot. And then the other thing was that there was a relatively large protest in Hong Kong when China, which evidently allowed Hong Kong a little bit, you might be able to characterize it better than I, but a little bit of autonomy in terms of adjudicating cases, and there's a substantial number of liberals that for that reason live in Hong Kong, and Chinese said, "Yeah, that will no longer happen. We will extradite whoever we choose to extradite to China, and they will be subject to Chinese legal system, not the Hong Kong legal system." And pretty decent riot broke out about that. That's why I get back to this confrontation with totalitarian governments, totalitarianism. The longer you push it down the road, the worse ultimately the price becomes. And I'm for the life of me, the person that I hear talk about it the most is the president, who talks about it in the most blunt language, talks about, China this, China that. But I would certainly like to hear somebody like the former Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who, when he would tackle a subject at the Shangri-La dialogues or something like that, he would lay it out for you logically. This is the rules-based international order. This is what's significant about that. This is where these issues come to roost, and this is why this is significant. This is our policy. This is what we'd like to see. And, as you said, that's important when you're asking other people to sign up for it. And to participate in it. So I don't know, pretty fairly disheartening. We're not talking about stupid people. So why? Give me the footnote that explains to me. Well, that would really anger. You're essentially, shaming the Chinese in public. We really don't want to do that. We'd like to negotiate. Well, at some point, don't you have to? Is it okay to talk about what's true? And then I guess probably not with totalitarian governments. It's my experience and my reading of history. You certainly don't want to do that. So anyway, your thoughts on any or all of that?
At some point, you do have to speak up or otherwise allow yourself to be enslaved. You've got to. And actually going back even farther, one good example that's worth reading if there's Bible-fearing people who are listen to your show, is the example of when the walls of Jerusalem were rebuilt. And this was back in Babylonian days. And it's a very interesting account. I just can't remember who it was that rebuilt them. But if you hit the internet, it'll come up. And it's, but you know, they built it, and there was this huge political warfare effort to stop them, claiming they were traitors to the king, et cetera, et cetera. And so they had to deal with that. But behind the, as they were doing the building, it says in the Bible that they also had an array of archers. So they had some military protection too. But the whole story is so relevant to today in dealing with totalitarian countries like that. And in fact, the bad guys even offered the Israelite, they said, why don't you come over for a great party as well, which is kind of the, before they started to threaten him, which is kind of the Chinese MO, as James Lilly, the very well-respected former U.S. ambassador, said. First they try to bribe you, then they try to scare you, and after that they're stumped. But I would recommend going back and reading that. It gives you some encouragement that none of what we're dealing with is new. Now, jumping along to when you mentioned James General Mattis, that if I had thought of him, I would have put him in the article, as I think he would have been, he potentially could have been, or maybe still could be, I think, that voice that we're talking about. Because he really, one, he had a way of speaking that worked, but he was also held in regard by almost everybody.
No, you know, one of the interesting things about following him as the Secretary of Defense when you watched his international appearances, whether they would be at NATO or at the Shangri-La Dialogue, or some major foreign policy defense tilted event, people were a Twitter that he was there, and you could tell by the mannerisms of the people that introduced him, by whoever was running the whole event, coming and making comments, and I mean, to me, and then to see the regard that he was held with by the people that attended was pretty amazing. In fact, a friend of mine mentioned to me yesterday that that Mattis was as close as we've come to somebody with Marshall-like credentials since Marshall. And I said, you know what, it's a shame that he's no longer part of, our government, because I absolutely agree with that. But I don't think anybody's going to tell him to shut up in color when he intellectually believes it's not in the best long-term interest for the nations. But it's somebody like that can lay it out simply. And one of his great gifts was he would not poke them in the chest while he was doing it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you've seen him, Grant. He had this way of illustrating it, pointing it out, talking about where American, interests lied. And then ultimately, it was for nations to come together and figure out. But he would not, poke his finger in their sternum, to pick a fight. He was always, deferential, and he's always respectful. And, so along those lines, no, I think you're absolutely correct in somebody like him. But the only person I see that articulates it in any depth is the president. And I think that's poor.
I agree. It's General Mattis, he had, not everyone has that ability. It's got that magic, and he had it somehow. Also worth noting how our adversaries viewed him. When he spoke, they listened.
Right.
And that's important. And you also noted that the people who despise Donald Trump even far more than they do totalitarian systems, also, everybody would listen to General Mattis, like the old E.F. Hutton commercials that only people of our age would remember. It's when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. And I say he had it, and maybe he'll come back around on the scene, but one hopes we get him or somebody like it sooner rather than later.
Right. All right, Grant, what are you working on next? What's the next thing we're going to see you publish?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe that Hungarian Revolution bit. I sort of talked myself through it this morning. I've been thinking about it. There's a couple things, and one that One that talks about the Quislings on the U.S. side that are just waiting for that the return of JB 2020 missile, the Joe Biden 2020. I think we do have some people, I say, on our side who are sort of measuring the curtains for the State Department and Department of Defense, and we will see how that turns out.
All right. Grant Newsham, thank you very much, sir. We always appreciate the visit, and you have many fans here, and I got a number of people that said, what do you mean Grant's not on this morning? So I appreciate you for hopping back in here, and always enjoy the visit, and you making us smarter, Grant. Thank you.
Okay, appreciate it. Always enjoy it. Thank you.
There you have it, Grant Newsham. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.